Welcome to Reading Together, a Near FM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision Fund. The Near FM crew travelled to public locations around the city where different readers from local communities read the 15 stories that constitute James Joyce's book, The Dubliners. Dubliners was designated by Dublin, One City, One Book, as 2011 Book of the Year. Near FM wants to join in the celebration, organising a series of public readings where Joyce's Dubliners would be read in public places to reach a wider audience. Today we are travelling to Sphere 17, the youth resource centre for Dublin 17 in Darndale, where some of the youth involved in the project read from an encounter. But first we spoke to Stephen Blades, one of the youth project workers, about the preparations and how the young people took on reading the stories, though some of them didn't know who James Joyce was.
They know the name again, they just know the name, but they don't know. I think one of the lads said James Joyce Ulysses, but he didn't. I think one of them didn't. I know the Dubliners, but he's so stayed there. But it was just a, you know, recognizing the name kind of thing, really. You know, my name's Blades. I'm a youth worker in Sphere 17, which is the regional youth service for Dublin 17, and we're based here in Darndale, and we work with Dublin 17 young people between 10 and 20, 21 years old, doing all kinds of stuff, different programmes, projects, needs-based activities, all kinds. We've done a few projects that are spoken word type projects, and we've done some kind of slam poetry type projects, but that's probably the closest thing to traditional literature, I suppose, was that kind of stuff. We've done quite a few spoken word projects, but we've never done too much around actual reading, if you know what I mean. There was a young group that were involved in this project, a young primary school group that was the first programme that was kind of just a reading group. They used to just read stories to each other and it was kind of like just a storytelling group, and that was the first of its kind that we'd done, do you know. Well, they'd all heard of Dubliners. They wouldn't have known too much about it. None of them would have read it, to be honest. You know, the group, our young people that worked with us here on the project, there was about six of them were primary school age, so they weren't really sure what it was, but they'd been doing this kind of reading programme, so they were just keen to be involved and do something together and just to give something a go. The other three or four people involved were like 17, 18 year olds, and we just asked them what they'd like to do it, and they says, well, we don't really know what it is, but we'll give it a go. So they were just keen to be involved. And some of the young people we work with are always keen to kind of just try new things, you know. And this was kind of a new thing for them to be doing, just reading in front of a group of people. Well, we had the two stories printed off. Two colleagues of mine had gone through the stories with the younger group, and they broke the stories down in like shorter paragraphs, so it wasn't too big a read or too challenging, because this younger group are kind of like 11 years oldest, you know. So they did that. The older young people that were like 17, say, I just kind of explained what it was. I gave them a copy of the story. They had a quick little look through it, a photocopy. One of them wasn't comfortable with the photocopy and wanted to read it from the book. And so he actually wanted to physically hold the book, and I thought that was quite interesting. And we just talked them through it. The older young people, what was interesting, they were quite confident. They were like, yeah, no, but we'll just read it, give it us. But then when it came to actually sitting in front of the microphone and reading it in front of a few of their peers, and then the younger group and some of the youth workers, they found it really hard, they found it really difficult, and they were a little bit daunted by it. And I read a bit myself, and it wasn't as easy as you'd think, you know, just reading. I suppose there was probably about 20 people there between other young people and a few staff and people with the microphones and what. It's probably about 20 people, but if you're not used to reading, it was quite a new experience, you know. I think the younger people, if I was honest, the younger people were so kind of focused on getting the words out and reading it correctly and the grammar and the pronunciation and stuff, that the 11-year-olds, I think the story became a bit lost on them, and they were kind of more focused about just doing a good job, if you know what I mean. The other older people, they got into it. There was a few little slight bits of humour that they thought were good, and they were familiar with the Dubliners, but they hadn't read it. So I think they were kind of surprised that there was even young person related stories in it, if you know what I mean. I think they kind of had this presumption that, oh, the Dubliners is some book about old fellas sitting in the pub smoking pipes or whatever, do you know? So they did kind of, oh, you know, they were a bit surprised. But I think there was a few young people there, older young people, that were friends with the three that read. But I think they were the ones that benefited the most, because they really more took the information in and they were able to listen a bit more. Because even the three that spoke, they were self-conscious. There was a certain amount of pressure that they didn't necessarily expect. So to sit there and read, I think it was when they were listening is when they kind of took it in, you know. But it was a really good experience for them because it was a surprise. They expected it to be really easy to just sit and read. And it was good for the self-esteem, and it kind of boosted the confidence. And it kind of, the thing that I always think, if you have seven people reading there, and if one of them young people gets a taste for it and thinks, oh, well, do you know, I wouldn't mind reading more, I might go and join the local library, or I wouldn't mind doing this again, or I wouldn't mind reading the rest of that particular book, The Dubliners or Mojo, then if there's one of them comes out with a bit of a seed planted to develop something, then it's the whole project's kind of a success. Well, the lad, Micah, who was the lad that wanted to read from the book as opposed to a photocopy, he's been reading more and more over the months, and he's actually at the moment really into all these graphic novels kind of thing, you know, these Walking Deads and all that kind of stuff, and he's really into that, and he's a big movie fan as well, and he's reading more and more, so I like to think that was kind of a part of his kind of becoming a fan of reading almost, you know, because a lot of young people don't read. Like, we have a selection of books here in Sphere 17 upstairs, and we're always encouraging young people to access them and buy them and what have you. And you do come across a lot of young people that read, but the thing is, it's finding that out, because a lot of young people, even though they might read in bed at night, a lot of the girls seem to read as well in bed at night, but they don't. Nobody knows that. It's kind of almost not fashionable to be known as a reader, almost, do you know what I mean? But there's a lot of young people there that read, but they kind of almost keep it quiet. So it's kind of one of our things is to kind of, you know, find out who is that, and then try and push and promote and support that.
Thanks, Blades. And next is Araby.
Araby, North Richmond Street, being blind, was a quiet street except at the hour when the Christian Brothers School set the boys free. An uninhabited house of two stories stood at the blind end, detached from its neighbours in a square ground. The other houses of the street, conscious of decent lives within them, gazed at one another with brown, imperturbable faces. The former tenant of our house, a priest, had died in the back drawing room. Air, musty from having been long enclosed, hung in all the rooms, and the waste room behind the kitchen was littered with old, useless papers. Among these, I found a few paper-covered books, the pages of which were curled and damp. The Abbot by Walter Scott, The Devout Communicant, and The Memoirs of Vidocq. I liked the last best because its leaves were yellow. The wild garden behind the house contained a central apple tree and a few straggling bushes, under one of which I found the late tenant's rusty bicycle pump. He had been a very charitable priest. In his will, he had left all his money to institutions and the furniture of his house to his sister.
When the first day of winter came, dusk fell before we had well eaten our dinners. When we met in the street, the houses had grown somber. The space of the sky above us was the colour of ever-changing violet, and towards it the lamps of the street lifted their feeble lanterns. The cold air stung us, and we played till our bodies glowed. Our shouts echoed in the silent street. The career of our play brought us through the dark, muddy lanes behind the houses, where we ran the gauntlet of the rough tribes from the cottages to the back doors of the dark dripping gardens, where odours arose from the ash pits to the dark odorous stables, where the coachman to the street light from the kitchen windows had filled the areas. If my uncle was seen turning the corner, we hid in the shadow until we had seen him safely housed, or if Mangan's sister came out on the doorstep to call her brother in to his tea, we watched her from our shadow pier. Up and down the street we waited to see whether she would remain or go, and if she remained, we left our shadow and walked up to Mangan's, stepped resignedly. She was waiting for us, her figure defined by the light from the half-open door. Her brother always teased her before he obeyed, and I stood by the railings looking at her dress swung and as she moved her body and the soft rope of her hair tossed from side to side.
Every morning I lay on the floor in the front parlour watching her door. The blind was pulled down to within an inch of the sash so that I could not be seen. When she came out on the doorstep, my heart leaped. I ran to the hall, seized my books and followed her. I kept her brown figure always in my eye, and when we came near the point at which our ways diverged, I quickened my pace and passed her. This happened morning after morning. I had never spoken to her except for a few casual words, and yet her name was like a summons to all my foolish blood.
Her image accompanied me even places most hostile to romance. On Saturday evenings, my aunt went marketing. I had to carry some of the parcels. We walked through the flaring streets joisted by drunken men and bargaining women, amid to the cruises of labourers and the shrill litanies of shop boys who stood on guard by the barrel of pig cheeks, the nasty chatting of street singers who sang "Come All You" about O'Donnell Ross, or bawling about the troubles in our native land. These noises converged into a single sensation of life for me. I imagined that I bore my chalice safely through a throng of foes. Her name sprang to my lips at moments in strange prayers and praises, which I myself did not understand. My eyes were often full of tears, I could not tell why. At times, a flood from my heart seemed to pour out itself into my bosom. I thought little of the future. I did not know whether I would ever speak to her or not. If I spoke to her, how would I tell her of my confused adoration? But my body was like a harp. Her words and gestures were like fingers running upon the wires.
One evening I went into the back drawing room in which the priest had died. It was a dark rainy evening and there was no sound in the house. Through one of the broken panes I heard the rain impinge upon the earth, the finest incessant needles of water playing in the sodden beds. Some distant lamp or lighted window gleamed below me. I was thankful that I could see so little. All my senses seemed to desire to veil themselves, and feeling that I was about to slip from them, I pressed the palms of my hands together until they trembled, murmuring, "O love," many times. At least she spoke to me. When she addressed the first words to me, I was so confused that I did not know what to answer. She asked me, was I going to Araby? I forgot whether I answered yes or no. It would be a splendid bazaar. She said she would love to go. And why can't you? I asked.
While she spoke, she turned a silver bracelet round and round her wrist. She could not go, she said, because there would be a retreat that week in her convent. Her brother and her two other boys were fighting for their caps, and I was alone at the railings. She held one of the spikes, bowing her head towards me. The light from the lamp opposite our door caught the white curve of her neck, lit up her hair that rested there, and falling, lit up the hand upon the railing. It fell over one side of her dress and caught the white border of her petticoat, just visible as she stood at ease. "It's well for you," she said. "If I go," I said, "I will bring you something."
What innumerable follies laid waste my waking and sleeping thoughts after at evening. I wished to annihilate to the tedious intervening days. I chafed against the work of skill at night in my bedroom and by day in my classroom. Her image came between me and the page. I strove to read the syllables. The word Aribi were called to me through the silence in which my soul lyric shade and cast an eastern enchantment over me. I asked for leave to go to the bazaar on Saturday night. My aunt was surprised. She and hoped it was not some Freemason affair. I answered a few questions in class. I watched my master's face pass from the amiability to sternness. He hoped I was not beginning to idle. I could not call my wandering thoughts together. I had hardly any patience with the serious of work, which now that I stood between me and my desire seemed to me child's play, ugly, monotonous child's play. On Saturday morning, I reminded my uncle that I wished to go to the bazaar in the evening. He was fussing at the hall stand looking for the hat brush and answered me curtly, "Yes, boy, I know." As he was in the hall, I could not go into the front parlour and lie at the window. I left my house in a bad humour and walked slowly towards the school in an air piteous raw, and already my heart misgave me.
When I came home to dinner, my uncle had not yet been home. Still, it was early. I sat staring at the clock for some time, and when it was ticking, began to irritate me. I left the room. I mounted the staircase and gained the upper part of the house. The high, cold, empty, glooming rooms liberated me, and I went from room to room singing. From the front window, I saw my companions playing below the street. The cries reached me weakened and indistinct, and leaning my forehead against the cool glass, I looked over at the dark house where she lived. I may have stood there for an hour, seeing nothing but the brown-clad figure cast by my imagination, touched discreetly by the lamplight at the curved neck and the hand upon the railings and the border below the dress. When I came downstairs again, I found Mrs. Mercer sitting at the fire. She was an old, glamorous woman, a pawnbroker's widow who collected used stamps for some priest propose. I had to endure the gossip of the tea table. The meal was prolonged beyond an hour, and still my uncle did not come. Mrs. Mercer stood up to go. She was so sorry she couldn't wait any longer, but it was after 8 o'clock and she did not like to be out, as the night air was bad for her. She had gone to began to walk up down the room, clenching fist. My aunt said, "I'm afraid you may put off your bazaar of this night, O Lord."
At 9 o'clock, I heard my uncle's latch key in the door. I heard him talking to himself, and I heard the hall stand rocking when it had received the weight of his overcoat. I could interpret these signs. When he was midway through his dinner, I asked him to give me the money to go to the bazaar. He'd forgotten. "The people are in bed and after their first sleep now," he said. I did not smile. My aunt said to him energetically, "Can't you give him the money and let him go? You've kept him late enough as it is." My uncle said he was very sorry he had forgotten. He said he believed in the old sayings, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy." He asked me where I was going, and when I had told him a second time, he asked me, "Did I know the Arab's farewell to his steed?" When I left the kitchen, he was about to recite the opening lines of the piece to my aunt. I held the forlorn tightly in my hands as I strode back Buckingham Street towards the station. The side of the street thronged with buyers and glaring with gas recalled to me the purpose of my journey. I took my seat in the first class carriage of a deserted train. After an intolerable delay, the train moved out of the station slowly. It crept onwards among ruinous houses and over the twinkling river. At West Lawn Row Station, a crowd of people pressed to the carriage doors, but the porters moved them back, saying that it was a special train for the bazaar. I remained alone in the bare carriage. In a few minutes, the train drew up beside the impoverished wooden platform. I passed out onto the road and saw by the lighted dial of a clock that it was 10 minutes to 10. In front of me was a large building which displayed the magical name. I could not find any sixpenny entrance, and fearing that the bazaar would be closed, I passed in quickly through a turnstile, handing a shilling to a weary-looking man. I found myself in a big hall, girdled at half its height by a gallery. Nearly all the stalls were closed, and the greater part of the hall was in darkness. I recognised the silence like that which pervaded a church after a service. I walked into the centre of the bazaar timidly. A few people were gathered after the stalls, which were still open. Before a curtain, over which the words Café Chantant were written in coloured lamps, two men were counting money as a slaver. I listened to a haul of the coins.
Remembering with difficulty why I had come, I went over to one of the stalls and examined porcelain vases and flower tea sets. At the door of the stalls, a young lady was talking and laughing with two young gentlemen. I remarked their English accents and listened vaguely to their conversation. "Oh, I never said such a thing." "Oh, but you did." "Oh, but I didn't." "Didn't she say that?" "Yes, I heard that." "Oh, there's a fib."
Observing me, the young lady came over and asked me, did I wish to buy anything? The tone of her voice was not encouraging. She seemed to have spoken to me out of a sense of duty. I looked humbly at the great jars that stood like Eastern guards at either side of the dark entrance to the stall and murmured, "No, thank you." The young lady changed the position of one of the vases and went back to the young men. They began to talk of the same subject. Once or twice, the young lady glanced at me over her shoulder, lingered before her stall, though I knew my stay was useless to make my interest in her wares seem the more real. Then I turned away slowly and walked down the middle of the bazaar. I allowed the two pennies to fall against the sixpence in my pocket. I heard a voice call from one end of the gallery that the light was out. The upper part of the hall was now completely dark. Gazing up into the darkness, I saw myself as a creature driven and derided by vanity, and my eyes burned with anguish and anger.
You are listening to Reading Together, a Near FM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision Fund. For the break, we listen to Araby, read by the 10 to 14-year-olds. Next, we are going to hear the younger crew of Sphere 17, reading An Encounter.
It was Joe Dillon who introduced the Wild West to us. He had a little library made up of all numbers of the Union Jack, Pluck and a Halfpenny Marvel. Every evening after school, we met in the Black Garden and arranged Indian battles. He and his fat young brother, Leo and Idler, held in the law of stable while we tried to carry it by storm, or we fought a pitched battle on the grass. But however well we fought, we never won siege or battle, and all our bouts ended with Joe Dillon's war dance of victory. His parents went to 8 o'clock mass every morning in Gardiner Street, and the peaceful odour of Mrs. Dillon was prevalent in the hall of the house. But he played too fiercely for us who were younger and more timid. He looked like some kind of Indian when he capered around the garden, and the old tea cosy on his head, beating a tin with his fist and yelling, "Ya, yaka, yaka, yaka." Everyone was incredulous. when it was reported that he had a vocation for the priesthood. Nevertheless, it was true. A spirit of unruliness diffused itself among us, and under its influence, differences of cultures and constitution were waived. We banded ourselves together, some boldly, some in jest, and some almost in fear of the number of the latter. The reluctant Indians, who were afraid to seem dubious or lacking in robustness, I was one. The adventures related in the literature of the Wild West were remote from my nature, but at least they opened doors of escape. I liked better some American detective stories, which were traversed from time to time, but unkept, fierce and beautiful girls. Though there were nothing wrong with these stories, and though their intention was sometimes literary and were circulated secretly at school, one day when Father Butler was hearing the four pages of Roman history, clumsy Leo Dillon was discovered with a copy of the Halfpenny Marvel. This page now, Dillon, up. Hardly had the day go on. What day? Hardly had the day dawned. Have you studied it? What have you in your pocket? Everyone's heart palpitated as Leo Dillon handed up the paper, and everybody's assumed an innocent face. Father Butler turned over the pages, frowning. What is this rubbish? He said. The Apache chief, is this what you read instead of studying your Roman history? Let me not find any more of this wretched stuff in college. The man who wrote it, I suppose, was some wretched fellow who writes these things for a drink. I'm surprised that boys like you educated reading stuff like this. I could understand it if you were national school boys. Now, Dillon, I advise you strongly to get your work or the rebuke during the sober hours of school paled much of the glory and Wild West for me, and the confused, puffy face of Leo Dillon awakened one of my consciences. But when the restraining influence of the school was at a distance, I began to hunger again for wild sensations, for the escape which those chronicles of order alone seemed to offer me. The mimic warfare of the evening became at least as wearisome to me as routine of school in the morning, because I wanted real adventures to happen to myself. But real adventures, I reflected, do not happen to people who remain at home. They must be sought abroad. The summer holidays were near at hand, and I made up my mind to break out of the weariness of school life for one day at least. With Leo Dillon and a boy named Mahony, I planned a day's mitching. Each of us saved up 6 pence. We were to meet in ten in the morning on the canal bridge. Matney's big sister was to write an excuse for him, and Leo Dillon was to tell his brother to say he was sick. We arranged to go along the wharf road until we came up to the ships, then to cross in the ferry boat and walk out to sea, Pigeon House. Leo Dillon was afraid we might meet Father Butler or someone out of the college, but Mahony asked very sensibly what would Father Butler be doing out at the Pigeon House. We were reassured, and I brought a first stage of the plot to an end by collecting 6 pence from the other two, at the same time showing them my own 6 pence. When we were making the last arrangements on the eve, we were all vaguely excited. We shook hands laughing, and Mahony said, "Till tomorrow, mates."
That night I slept badly. In the morning I was forced to come out to the bridge as I lived nearest. I hid my books in the long grass near the ash pit at the end of the garden where nobody ever came, and hurried along the canal bank. It was a mild sunny morning in the first week of June. I sat up on the coping of the bridge admiring my frail canvas shoes, which I had diligently pipe clayed overnight, and watching the docile horses pulling a tramload of business people up the hill. All the branches of the tall trees which lined the mail
were gay with little light grey leaves and the sunlight slanted through them onto the water. The granite stone of the bridge was beginning to be warm and I began to pat it with my hands, in time to an air in my head. I was very happy. When I had been sitting there for 5 or 10 minutes, I saw a man in his grey suit approaching. He came up the hill, smiling, and clambered up beside me on the bridge. While we were waiting, he brought out the catapult, which bulged from his inner pocket, and explained some improvements which he had made in it. I asked him why he had brought it, and he told me he had brought it to have some gas with the boats. Many used slang freely and spoke of Father Butler as Old Bunza. We waited on for a quarter of an hour, but still there was no sign of Leo Dillon. Mahoney at last jumped down and said, "Come along." I knew Fatty'd funk it. "And his sixpence," I said. "That's forfeit," said Mahoney. "And so much the better for us, a bob and a tanner instead of a bob." We walked along the North Strand Road till we came to the Fitzroy Works and then turned to the right along the Wharf Road. Mahoney began to play the Indian as soon as we were out of public sight. He chased a crowd of ragged girls, brandishing his unloaded catapult, and when two ragged boys began out of chivalry to fling stones at us, he proposed that we should charge them. I objected that the boys were too small, and so we walked on, the ragged troops screaming after us, "Swaddlers, swaddlers," thinking that we were Protestants because Mahoney, who was dark complexioned, wore the silver badge of a cricket club in his cap. When we came to the Smoon Iron, we arranged aside, but it was a failure because you must have at least three. We revenged ourselves on Leo Dillon by saying what a funk he was and guessing how many he would get at 3 o'clock from Mr. Ryan.
We came then near the river. We spent a long time walking about the noisy streets, flanked by high stone walls, watching the working of cranes and engines, and often being shouted at for our immobility by the drivers of groaning carts. It was noon when we reached the quays, and as all the labourers seemed to be eating their lunches, we bought 2 big currant buns and sat down to eat them on some metal pipeline beside the river. We placed ourselves with the spectacle of Dubliners' commerce. The barges signalled from far away by their curls of woolly smoke. The brown fishing fleet beyond Ringsend, the big white sailing vessel which was being discharged at the opposite quay. Mahoney said it would be right skit to run away to the sea on one of those big ships, and even I, looking at the high mast, saw or imagined the geography which had been scantily closed to me at school gradually taking substance under my eyes. School and home seemed to recede from us, and their influences upon us seemed to wane. We crossed the Liffey in the ferry boat, paying our toll to be transported to the company of 2 labourers and a little Jew with a bag. We were serious at the point of solemnity, but once during the short voyage our eyes met and we laughed. When we landed, we watched the discharging of the graceful tree-master which had observed from the other quay. Some bystander said that there was a Norwegian vessel. I went to the stern and tried to decipher the legend upon it. Failing to do so, I came back and examined the foreign sailors to see had any of them green eyes, for I had some confused notion. The sailors' eyes were blue and grey and even black. The only sailor whose eyes could have been called green was a tall man who assumed the crowd of the quay by calling out cheerful every time the planks fell, "All right, all right." When we were tired of this sight, we wandered slowly into Ringsend. The day had grown sultry. In the windows of the grocer shops, Musty's biscuits lay bleaching. We bought some biscuits and chocolate, which we ate soothlessly as we wandered through the squalid streets where the families of the fishermen live. We could find no dairy, and so we went into the husker's shop and bought a bottle of raspberry lemonade each. Refreshed by this, Mahoney chased a cat down the lane, but the cat escaped into a wide field. We both felt rather tired. When we reached the field, we made at once for a sloping bank over the ridge of which we could see the Dobber. It was too late, and we were too tired to carry out our project of visiting the pigeon house. We had to be home before 4 o'clock, lest our adventure should be discovered. Mahoney looked regretfully at his catapult, and I had to suggest going home by train before I regained any cheerfulness. The sun went in behind some clouds and left us to our jab thoughts and the crumbs of our provisions.
There was nobody but ourselves in the field. When we had lain on the bank for some time without speaking, I saw a man approaching from the far end of the field. I watched him lazily as I chewed on one of those green stems on which the girls tell fortunes. He came along by the bank slowly. He walked with one hand upon his hip, and in the other hand he held a stick with which he tapped the turf lightly. He was shabbily dressed in a suit of greenish black and wore what we used to call a jerry hat with a high crown. He seemed to be fairly old, for his moustache was ashen grey. When we passed at our feet, he glanced up at us quickly and then continued his way. We followed him with our eyes and saw that when he had gone on for perhaps 50 paces, he turned about and began to retrace his steps. He walked towards us very slowly, always tapping the ground with his stick, so slowly that I thought he was looking for something in the grass. He stopped when he came level with us and bade us a good day. We answered him and he sat down beside us on the slope slowly and with great care. He began to talk of the weather, saying that it would be very hot summer and adding that the seasons had changed greatly since he was a boy a long time ago. He said that the happiest time of one's life was undoubtedly one's schoolboy days, and that he would give anything to be young again. When he expressed these sentiments, which bored us all a little, we kept silent. Then he began to talk of school and of books. He asked us whether we had read the poetry of Thomas Moore or the works of Sir Walter Scott and Lord Lytton. I pretended that I had read every book he mentioned, so in the end he said, "Ah, I can see you are a bookworm like myself." "Now," he added, pointing to Mahoney, who was regarding us with his open eyes, "he is different. He goes in for games." He said he had all Sir Walter Scott's works and all Lord Lytton's works at home and never tired of reading them. "Of course," he said, "there were some of Lord Lytton's works which boys couldn't read." Mahoney asked why couldn't boys read them, a question which agitated and pained me because I was afraid the man would think I was as stupid as Mahoney. The man, however, only smiled. I saw that he had great gaps in his mouth between his yellow teeth. And then he asked which of us had the most sweethearts. Mahoney mentioned lightly that he had 3 totties. The man asked me how many I had. I answered that I had none. He did not believe me and said he was sure I must have one. I was silent. "Tell us," said Mahoney pertly to the man, "how many have you had yourself?" The man smiled as before and said that when he was our age, he had lots of sweethearts. Every boy, says, has a sweetheart.
His attitude on this point struck me as strangely liberal in a man of his age. In my heart, I thought that what he said about boys and sweethearts was reasonable. But I disliked the words in his mouth, and I wondered why he shivered once or twice, as if he feared something or felt a sudden chill. As he proceeded, I noticed that his accent was good. He began to speak to us about girls, saying what nice soft hair they had, and how soft their hands were, and how all girls were not so good as they seemed to be if one only knew. There was nothing he liked, he said, so much as looking at a nice young girl, at her nice white hands and her beautiful soft hair. He gave me the impression that he was repeating something which he had learnt by heart, or that magnetised by some words of his own speech, his mind was slowly circling round and round in the same orbit. At times he spoke as if he were simply alluding to some fact that everybody knew, and at times he lowered his voice and spoke mysteriously, as if he were telling us something secret, which he did not wish others to overhear. He repeated his phrases over and over again, varying them and surrounding them with a monotonous voice. I continued to gaze towards the foot of the slope, listening to him. After a long while, his monologue paused. He stood up slowly, saying that he had to leave us for a minute or so, a few minutes, and without changing direction of my gaze, I saw him walking slowly away from us towards the near end of the field. We remained silent when he had gone. After a silence of a few minutes, I heard Mahoney explain, "I say, look what he's doing." As I neither answered nor raised my eyes, Mahoney exclaimed again, "I say, he's a queer old jodger." In case he asks us for our names, I said, "Let you be Murphy and I'll be Smith." We said nothing further to each other.
I was still considering whether I would go away or not when the man came back and sat down beside us again. Hardly had he sat down when Mahony, catching sight of the cat which had escaped, sprang up and pursued her across the field. The man and I watched the chase. The cat escaped once more and Mahony began to throw stones at the wall she was escaped. Desisting from this, he began to wander about the far end of the field aimlessly. After the interval, the man spoke to me. He said that my friend was a very rough boy and asked did he get whipped often at school. I was going to reply indigently that we were not national school boys to be whipped, as he called it, but I remained silent. He began to speak on the subject of chastising boys. His mind, as if magnetised again by his speech, seemed to circle slowly round and round its new centre. He said that when boys were that kind, they ought to be whipped and well whipped. When a boy was rough and unruly, there was nothing would do him any good but a good sound whipping. A slap on the hand or a box on the ear was no good. What he wanted was to get a nice warm whipping. I was surprised at this sentiment and involuntarily glanced up at his face. As I did so, I met the gaze of a pair of bottle green eyes peering at me from under a twitching forehead. I turned my eyes away again. The man continued his monologue. He seemed to have forgotten his recent liberalism. He said that if ever he found a boy talking to girls or having a girl for a sweetheart, he would whip him and whip him, and that would teach him not to be talking to girls. And if a boy had a girl for a sweetheart and told lies about it, then he would give him such a whipping as no boy ever got in this world. He said that there was nothing in this world he would like so well as that. He described to me how he would whip such a boy as if he were unfolding some elaborate mystery. He would love that, he said, better than anything in this world. And his voice, as he led me monotonously through the mystery, grew almost affectionate and seemed to plead with me that I should understand him. I waited till his monologue paused again. Then I stood up abruptly. Lest I should betray my agitation, I delayed a few moments, pretending to fix my shoe properly, and then, seeing that I was obliged to go, I bade him goodbye. I went up the slope calmly, but my heart was beating quickly, with fear that he would seize me by the ankles. When I reached the top of the slope, I turned around, and without looking at him, called loudly across the field, "Murphy!" My voice had an accent of forced bravery in it, and I was ashamed of my paltry straggonism. I had to call the name again before Mahony saw me and hollowed in answer. How my heart beat as he came running across the field to me. He ran as if to bring me aid, and I was penitent, for in my heart I had always despised him a little.
James Joyce's writing was an inspiration not only for other writers, but also to musicians, who referenced to him in some of their songs. So we are closing today's programme listening to the Beatles' I Am a Walrus. Some have claimed that Go, Go, Good Job is a reference to James Joyce's dense classic Finnegan's Wake, published in 1939, which contains the phrase Go, Go, Gosh, on page 557. While it is known that Lennon had read the book in 1967, having already been told his lyrics were Joycean, there is no evidence that he consciously played upon this phrase. Before we go, we want to thank our readers, Kaylee O'Connor, Jason Graydon, Kathy Heffernan, Abby McPetridge, Chloe Kennedy, Dale McMahon, Danielle Baker, Michael McCreary, and Stephen Blades, and the Sphere 17 for their support.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.